All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Here we are, your own flesh and blood. Even while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led us out to battle and brought us back. The Lord also said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will be ruler over Israel.'" So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron. King David made a covenant with them at Hebron in the Lord's presence, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began his reign. He reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. David became more and more powerful, and the Lord God of armies was with him. King Hiram of Tyre sent envoys to David. He also sent cedar logs, carpenters, and stonemasons, and they built a palace for David. Then David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel and had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. This is the word of the Lord.
This is a large passage. We're going to be looking through 2 Samuel 3 all the way through 6. And we've got 35 minutes. Now, if you know me, well, we're going to try. Life is hard. You know, life is hard when you've got time limits. Life is hard when it just feels confusing. The circumstances of life can be chaotic. Home life can be difficult. Emotional life can be difficult, that internal turmoil of being impacted by the things out there. And things out there can be chaotic, difficult, confusing. And the question for people who follow Jesus is, how do I stay faithful to our King? And how do I have peace? And you may be surprised, if you're familiar with this passage, to find that it leads to peace. This passage follows a trajectory in David's life, and it ends in chapter 6 in peace. But peace always leads in the Bible to Jesus. And so what we're going to find today is that God's providence, his forestness, is going to lead David to patience, and proactive patience at that. And that confidence in God's providence leads to confidence that he's not just for David, but will protect him. And so confidence in God's protection will lead David to prayerful dependence. And that prayerful dependence, when God delivers David, will lead him to worship. And worship will lead David to peace. So there's kind of the outline of where we're going. And if that's all you remember today, and we don't get to the end of the chapter, then success. But let's open up chapter 3, where we're going to find out that providence, God's providence, leads to proactive patience. See, in the midst of all that chaos and the circumstances of life, it can be difficult to feel like God is with you and for you. It can be difficult to see God active in your life. And as we know, David is quite a lot like us. All you have to do is turn to the Psalms and see him riff on the difficulties of life in classics like Psalm 2, according to Shimoneth, classic tune, or Psalm 22, according to the Deer of the Dawn, another classic. God, where are you? What are you doing? And why have you abandoned me? If you've ever felt that way, you're not alone. And so in the life of David, starting in verse 3, we learn that he's in the middle of a civil war. It says, during the long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, David was growing stronger, and the house of Saul was becoming weaker. Now, this is kind of the heading of this section from chapter 3 up into part of chapter 5, that we're in the middle of a civil war. David's on the rise, but there's still this opposition he's still facing from the house of Saul. And we read in chapter 6 that during the war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner, that is Saul's cousin and the general of all of his armies, Abner kept acquiring more power in the house of Saul. Now, Abner, what we learned in chapter 2 is that he's installed a puppet king. King Saul has been slain by the Philistines. Jonathan, the obvious heir, has been slain with him. And so there's this power vacuum, and Abner puts in this puppet named Ishbosheth. Killer name if you're looking for one. hint. Actually, it's terrible. It has to do with Baal and swapping consonants out to mean disgusting or despicable. So don't use Ishbosheth. But while David's house is getting stronger, over across the pond in the house of Saul, there's the civil war going on between Abner and Ishbosheth. Because Ishbosheth is just as paranoid as his father Saul, and he accuses Abner of a power grab. He says, "You've been sleeping with my father's concubine." And this wasn't just about romance or sex. Sleeping with the concubine of a king was a grab for power. It was saying, "I will take all the possessions of the former king, and I will put myself in his place." And so Ishbosheth comes to Abner, and he says, "Hey, I know you've been doing this." And from the text, it doesn't say whether or not Abner's been doing this, but he gets pretty upset, a little bit huffy, and he says, "What am I, a dog's head from the house of Judah?" Which is a great retort. He throws it back in Abner's Ishbosheth's face, and he says, "Look, I've been loyal to the house of Saul this whole time. Saul's been trying to kill David. I've been going after David for him. I haven't been a traitor at all. Why are you accusing me of this? But you know what? Fine. Listen to what I'm going to do." He says in verse 9, "May God punish Abner and do so severely if I don't do for David what Yahweh swore to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and to establish the throne of David over Israel and Judah from Dan to Beersheba." In other words, you've made a huge mistake. And all this influence and power that I've accumulated, I could just as easily give it to David as I've given it to you. And that's just what I'm going to do. Now, apparently, Abner has been aware of God's promise to David this whole time. He knows that God has said that he's going to give the kingdom to David as he's taken it away from Saul. Why hasn't he recognized it up until this point? Well, maybe it just didn't benefit him. And how often do we use, maybe consciously or unconsciously, God as an excuse for our benefit? There are these little vignettes of wisdom that we learn throughout these stories in these four chapters that we are not going to spend a whole lot of time going into, unfortunately, today. But this is what Abner does. He sends a message as his representatives to say to David, "Whose land is it?" In other words, like Israel, from Dan to Beersheba. "Make your covenant with me, and you can be certain I am on your side and turn all Israel over to you." So Abner doesn't come to David empty-handed, but he says, "I'll make you a trade. You promise me that for all of my running after you and trying to kill you, you'll forgive me. We'll make a covenant. I'll be on your side, and I'll give you Israel." Because remember, there's this civil war between David, who is only receiving recognition and loyalty from the tribe of Judah, and then the 11 other tribes who have given their loyalty and recognition to the house of Saul. And Abner says, I can change things up. Now, David says, "Yeah, that sounds pretty good." So he's receptive to Abner's offer, but he says, "Look, I've got a little trade of my own to propose. Give me Michal. You go get Michal." And now, if anybody remembers, Michal is David's first wife. She is the daughter of Saul. Saul gave her to David initially just to try and trip him up. He thought that it would crush David to be married to Michal for whatever reason. Maybe he'd be killed in the process of gathering 100 Philistine foreskins, which was the bride price. For whatever reason, he gives Michal to David. Michal loves David, and then Michal helps David escape from Saul, and at that point, Saul gives Michal to another man. So Michael's been living as the wife of another man, and David says, "I want her back. Take her for me. If you've got so much power and influence, you can make this happen." And Abner's like, "All right." And so that's what he does, and it's just tragic. It's clear that David doesn't really love her. It's just a political move. It says in verse 15, "So Ishbosheth sent someone to take her away," that is Michal, "from her husband Paltiel, son of Laish. Her husband followed her weeping all the way to Bahurim. Abner said to him, 'Go back.' And so he went back." It's just a brutal emotional scene. What David's doing is he's saying, give me Michael, and maybe I can unite the two tribes, the two factions. If I can produce an heir through Michael, the daughter of Saul, then the house of David and the house of Saul are united. It's a political move. It's not out of care for Michael, clearly, and without any thought to Paltiel, son of Laish. Now, Abner conferred in verse 17 with the elders of Israel. So he's made good on his promise to return Michael to David. And he goes to the elders of Israel and he says, in the past, you wanted David to be king over you. Now, take action, because Yahweh has spoken concerning David. Through my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the power of the Philistines and the power of all Israel's enemies. Abner uses his political influence to rally the tribes, the 11 tribes, and says, hey, you wanted this in the beginning. I don't know why you've gone after Ishbosheth. Like, come on, let's turn sides. And so he's actually successful. They're like, okay. And he goes to David, now with the support of the tribes, to see what David's going to do. And David welcomes him with a party, and he's like, this is awesome. He cuts the covenant. He's like, I'm going to protect you now. I've forgiven you for chasing after me and trying to kill me. And this is great. We'll unify the kingdom. Now, here's what David's doing. He's being proactive. He's not just sitting back and allowing things to happen. But he's also being patient. He's not going after power, trying to get the kingdom for himself. And that's because he's confident. As we read in chapter 5, verses 10 through 12, he's confident that God is with him and for him. So Abner says, hey, I'm glad this worked out. I'm glad that we could make this little deal. Let me go back to the elders of the tribes of Israel, let them know that everything's kosher, and we'll unite the kingdoms under your rule. It'll be awesome. And so David says three times, yeah, go in peace. Go in peace, which is kind of a shorthand way of saying he's under the protection of David. Now, just then, Joab, David's military leader, the counterpart to Abner on David's side of things, he comes back from a successful raid, and he sees the party, and he's like, what's going on? And he asks somebody, hey, what's going on? And they're like, oh, Abner was here. It was awesome. It was a little unexpected, but he was here. David like made a deal with him, and he sent him off in peace. He's got the protection of the king. And Abner or Joab is furious. Now, remember, in chapter 2, Joab's brother, Asahel, was killed in battle by Abner. And Joab's anger and his vengeance clouds his mind, clouds his vision. He can't see that God is actually delivering the kingdom to David through this guy he hates, and all he sees is the hatred and the desire for recompense. And so he goes to David, and he's like, you idiot. Now, for a military commander to come to the king and say, you idiot, it takes some moxie, let's say. He says, Abner's not here to deliver the kingdom to you. He's here to spy out what's going on. He's going to go back and tell Ishbosheth, Saul's son, what's going on. They're going to come here, and they're going to destroy us all. Now, whether or not he thinks this is beside the point, we don't know. We don't have those details. But what we know is that he uses it as an excuse. And without telling David, he sends a note to Abner, who's on his way back to get the people from Israel to align with David. And he sends this note, and he's like, hey, come on back to Hebron. And this is what we read in chapter 3, verse 27. When Abner returned to Hebron, Joab pulled him aside to the middle of the city gate as if to speak to him privately. And though there, Joab stabbed him in the stomach. So Abner died in revenge for the death of Asahel, Joab's brother. Brutal. Brutal. Now, Hebron, if you remember from Numbers 4, that like life verse that just pops in your head as soon as I say it, God set aside cities of refuge, places of safety for people who had accidentally killed somebody or killed somebody in battle, somebody like Abner, somebody who might be chased by somebody seeking blood vengeance, a city, a place of safety where they could go and they would be protected. And this is the very place Joab goes to and stabs Abner in the stomach. And you can just imagine him pulling him close and whispering for Azahel as he twists the knife. It's just brutal, gross, bloody stuff. He doesn't care that God is on the move, that God is working to unite a kingdom and to provide peace. All he can see is blood. Now, David hears about this and he's furious. One, because it causes huge problems for David. David's on the precipice of receiving the kingdom, and Joab, his military commander, has just made it look like he's actually killing the competition. And so all those people that Abner had rallied around David's cause might be thinking, this is all for show. He's really out to seize the kingdom on his own. This isn't God's man. He's just a smooth political actor. I don't think we want to follow him. And so David curses Joab. He curses his family. He curses his posterity. But he doesn't punish him. What we're going to see in chapter 4 is that he's perfectly capable of doing this. What we've seen in previous instances where something like this happens, he's perfectly capable of doing justice. And for whatever reason, maybe it's because Joab is a nephew. Maybe it's because Joab has a lot of influence in his own military. We don't know. It doesn't say. But he holds back from following through. Instead, he punishes him by making him a public mourner, to dress in the sign of mourning, to follow the coffin as the funeral procession goes out in public to mourn the loss of Abner. And David writes a song. He's weeping. He is cursing Joab. He's doing everything possible to publicly display his displeasure about what just happened. And then at the end of the day, in verse 35, the people come to urge David to eat food while it was still day. But David took an oath. May God punish me and do so severely if I taste bread or anything else before sunset. And so all the people are watching. All the people took note of this, and it pleased them. In fact, everything the king did pleased them. On that day, all the troops and all Israel were convinced that the king had no part in the killing of Abner, son of Ner. Okay, crisis averted. Maybe things are back on track. But at this point, now if you're David, at this point, a smooth political operator, the cynical person in you might be thinking, okay, the military leader is out of the way. The house of Saul is in disarray. I'm going to march up to Ishbosheth's house and cut the head off of Israel. I'm going to end this feud once and for all and take control. But remember, God's providence, the confidence that God is for David and will do all that he has promised, gives David the ability to be proactively patient. Instead of seizing power, he's patient. He trusts God. He knows that God is working. And so what we read now in chapter 4 is this. When Saul's son Ishbosheth heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he gave up and all Israel was dismayed. He gave up. His hands fell. Ugh, I don't have a military commander anymore. I'm probably next. What am I going to do? Well, it's probably a good time for a nap. I don't know what he's thinking, but it's like, I'm tired. This is maybe sometimes the way it is. It's too much. The chaos, the confusion, I don't know what to do. Just a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands. Just give it time. And this is what happens. In between verses 1 and 5, we learn that the only other person that has any claim to the throne is Mephibosheth. He is a boy who was dropped by his nanny, running for his life, and has had some sort of injury to his legs. He is lame. We'll go more into that when he comes up later in the story. But he's not fit to be a military commander and therefore disqualified from being king. And then Ishbosheth has hired a couple guys to be the leading military commanders of the raiding parties. The only problem is Ishbosheth is stupid. because these are guys with a personal vendetta against Saul, because Saul tried to slaughter their whole village, and they had to run and escape. So it's like, what's Ish-bosheth doing? Why is he hiring these guys? And in verse 5, we see Rahab and Baanah, these are the two guys that have a personal vendetta against the house of Saul, who have been put in charge of military, and they're employed by Ish-bosheth. Well, they set out and arrive at Ish-bosheth's house during the heat of the day while the king is taking his midday nap. They entered the interior of the houses as if they were to get wheat and stabbed him in the stomach. And they cut off his head, they escape and travel all night to David. And then they say this in verse 8. They brought Ish-bosheth's head to David at Hebron and said to the king, "Here's the head of Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, your enemy who intended to take your life. Today, Yahweh has granted vengeance to my lord, the king, against Saul and his offspring." Oh, my goodness, the drama. On the one hand, they're theologizing to cover sin, just like Abner. But on the other, it's like, what are you going to give us? We've done this great thing. Of course, they don't have very good memories, because if they did, they'd remember what David does to people who do things like this. And in verse 9, we're going to read here. David answered Rahab and his brother Baanah, sons of Ramon the Bereathite, "As the Lord lives, the one who has redeemed my life from every distress." What does David know? He knows that God is for him, that God is with him, that God protects him. He's got confidence in God's promise, in God's providence. In verse 10, it says, "When the person told me, 'Look, Saul is dead,' he thought he was a bearer of good news. But I seized him and put him to death at Ziklag." And at this point, these two guys are going, we've made a mistake. "That was my reward for him for his news. How much more when wicked men kill a righteous man in his own house on his own bed? So now should I not require his blood from you and purge you from the earth?" See, David doesn't buy it. He knows who his real redeemer is. And he doesn't credit these wicked men with being agents of God's providence. But this also introduces a problem. If Israel thought that the death of Abner was maybe David being disingenuous, how much more if the king dies? Is he responsible? And so it's a repeat of what happens in chapter 3. Public mourning. He executes these men for their assassination and hangs their hands and feet up for the public to see as a warning. Not just a warning, but a message. This is not the way I receive the kingdom. See, David has confidence and patience for God to deliver the kingdom to him. He's not going to go and assassinate the competition. But David's the golden boy. It all works out for him in the end. Look in verse 5, we see that God is at work to unite his people, establish his kingdom, and defeat evil, and that David is going to receive the kingdom from God with humility, and he's going to work proactively to establish the capital. In verse 1, we read, "All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, 'Here we are, your own flesh and blood. We're family. Even while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led us out to the battle and brought us back. Yahweh also said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will be ruler over Israel.'" So maybe the tribes of Israel have run out of options. They have no king, and really the only people that they can turn to with more power than David are the Philistines. Or maybe they're finally getting into their head now that they've run out of options. But God really has chosen David, and they're going to give him his due allegiance. And so they anoint him king. David has now received the kingdom from Yahweh, and the very next thing he does is an exercise in proactivity. That proactive patience turns straight into proactivity. In verse 6, the king and his men marched to Jerusalem against the Jebusites who inhabited the land. The Jebusites had said to David, "You will never get in here. Even the blind and lame can repel you," thinking David can't get in here. Yet David did capture the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. He said that day, "Whoever attacks the Jebusites must go through the water shaft to reach the lame and the blind who are despised by David. And for this reason, it is said, the blind and the lame will never enter the house." Now, two things. One, this has been a stronghold Israel has been unable to capture for about 5 centuries. They've tried since the Exodus to capture Jerusalem. David does it in a few verses. Clearly, God is at work in this scene. David has the confidence. We learn in Psalm 132 that David takes Jerusalem because he recognizes it is God's desire to be there. So somehow David's desire and God's desire correspond. He's being proactive once God has given him the kingdom to establish a center of power. The second thing, though, is there's this weird thing about God, David hating blind and lame people. And really what's going on here is that David has taken a taunt from the Jebusites and turned it against them. They've said, even the blind and lame can keep you out. He's like, fine, I'll show you who's really blind and lame. And he attacks the city of Jerusalem and takes it. And then he says, there's this little phrase, and therefore the blind and lame shall never enter the house. We know from later on in 2 Samuel that the lame certainly do enter the house, and not only enter the house, but eat at David's table on a regular basis. So it can't be that David hates lame people. It's about him taking that taunt and turning it back into the face of the Jebusites. I'll show you who are blind and lame. It's you. Do you see how God's providence is at work behind the stage, behind the scenes, to deliver the kingdom to David? And David's proactive patience is built on that confidence that God's providence is at work for him. Even when it doesn't seem like it, even when it seems like every circumstance is a setback, David knows God is with him, despite how he feels. And we know he feels a lot of things from the Psalms. How is that for you in your life? How often does it seem like God is not at work? I don't see any direction. I don't see any movement. Everything that's happening seems actually to be the opposite of what I hope for, what seems to lead to something good for me. See, if we have confidence that God is with us and for us, then even in those moments, despite how we feel, and we should feel, and we should express those, as David does in the Psalms, that God is at work for us. Now, next, we're going to see that this providence leads to protection, and that because David is confident that Yahweh will protect him, he prays. He has prayerful dependence. Look with me in verse 17. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they all went in search of David. But he heard about it and went down to the stronghold. So the Philistines came and spread out in Rephaim Valley. Now, remember, the Philistines have defeated every attempt to clear them from the land in the last 500 years. They've just killed Saul and Jonathan, David's best friend. This is a formidable foe. What is David going to do when faced with this kind of opposition? It's not like Jebusites, or maybe it is. In verse 19, then David inquired of the Lord, should I attack the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me? And Yahweh replied to David, attack, for I will certainly hand the Philistines over to you. David isn't just talking about God, what he's done for him in the past. He's talking to God in the present. He's praying to him, asking for guidance. What should I do? And God answers him. He's like, with a very ambiguous, vague thing. Yeah, go do it. I'll take care of it. And how often are our prayers answered with some vagary? I remember in 2011, I had an opportunity to become an international missionary in Honduras. I had an opportunity to stay in my job as an operations manager at a family-run construction company. I had the opportunity to go on staff at a small nonprofit in Portland. I had all these things, and I wasn't sure what to do. And so I went away for a very long weekend to ask God, what do I do? I read my Bible, and I journaled, and 5 days later, I got, do whatever you want to do. I'll be with you and I'll bless you. That's what I got. I was like, that's not the way it's supposed to work. Tell me what to do. And it's some vague, like, but man, he was. And he blessed me. And sometimes that's all the direction you get. Here's freedom. What are you going to do with it? I love you. I'm for you. I'm with you. Make a choice. My choice for you won't change. That's what God says to you in that prayer. But this isn't all. The Philistines do the exact same thing after God defeats them in this first battle. They retreat, but then they come back to the same place. And so sometimes we're faced with a decision. What do I do? And we've had a recent decision that seems like the same. And we're like, well, I'll just do what I did last time. It checks out. You know, it seems like kind of the wise thing. What do I do? But David goes to God in prayer, confident that God will protect him, but confident also that God has a plan. He wants to know what it is. And so in verse 19, in verse 22, it says, the Philistines came up again and spread out in Rephaim Valley. So David inquired of Yahweh, and he answered, do not attack directly, but circle around behind them and come at them opposite the balsam trees, or, as the King Jimmy says, the mulberry trees, which I like a lot more. There's a discrepancy on what kind of tree it is. Let's go with mulberry trees, can we? The CSB, balsam trees, it's probably accurate, but let's say mulberries. All right. When you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry tree, act decisively, for then Yahweh will have gone out ahead of you to strike down the army of the Philistines. So David did exactly as the Lord had commanded him, and he struck down the Philistines all the way from Geba to Gezer. So more important than the identification of the species, although we're going to go with mulberry trees, is this thing that God says. In the first one, he was like, I'll go out before you, attack, it'll be awesome. But in this one, he says, hold on, wait for me. Wait for the sound of the wind rustling in the mulberry trees. There's this rad thing that you'll notice if you read very old sermons from 100, 200, 300 years ago. People like Charles Spurgeon would just randomly, in the middle of a sermon, say something like, when you hear the sound of the mulberry trees. And everybody knew what he was talking about. See, sometimes God gives you a sign. Sometimes he gives you something that only you could know. But he says, wait until you get that sign. Wait until you hear the sound of the wind rushing in the mulberry trees. So David's proactive patience is turned into prayerful dependence and obedience, because as soon as he hears the sound of the wind and the mulberry trees, he springs into action. And now in chapter 6, we're going to see that this prayerful dependence turns into praise and peace because of God's presence. See, God's presence leads to praise and to peace. So in verse 1, we see David again assembled all the fit young men in Israel, 30,000. You're thinking, oh, it's going to be an army thing. He and all those troops set out to bring the Ark of God from Baal, Judah. Oh, maybe not. Weird. He's going to get the Ark. The Ark bears the name of Yahweh of armies, or Yahweh Shabaoth, who is enthroned between the cherubim. They set the Ark of God on a new cart and transported it from Abinadab's house, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the cart. And you're like, a new cart? That's a problem. Because the last time the ark went on a new cart, it was the Philistines toting it around. And it signaled the defeat of Israel. Something bad's going to happen. We're just sure of it. But the important thing here is that the ark bears the name, Hashem, the name of Yahweh Shabaoth, the Lord of armies. It's his military name. It's his kingly name. He's enthroned between the cherubim. It's the sign of his presence and his rule. And instead of a declaration of independence, a 4th of July, if you will, David declares dependence and establishes Yahweh as the center of Israel's universe. He wants to take God's presence, the symbol of God's presence and rule, up the hill to Jerusalem and establish him as the focal point of Israel's life. That's counterintuitive. The king should be the center of the people's universe, but not in the Bible. See, David recognizes that Yahweh is the king. So, trouble. They're bringing this ark on a new cart. And in verse 6, when they come to Nacon's threshing floor, Uzzah reached out to the ark of God and took hold of it because the oxen had stumbled. And then Yahweh's anger burned against Uzzah, and God struck him dead on the spot. And you're like, oh, there's the God of the Old Testament. That ancient heresy that says there's a difference between the God of the Old Testament and Jesus, this is one of those key passages where it's like, oh, totally different guys. See the discrepancies. And this is not the time, and I don't have the time for an apologetic. But you see that the reason is given. It's not just because the guy touched it, but because what it represented. God had given clear descriptions and commands of how his presence was to be treated. And Uzzah had clearly disobeyed, and it was a sign of his irreverence. And so David is like, oh my gosh, I'm terrified and I'm a little bit angry. In the past, God broke out against my armies, but now he's broken out against Uzzah. What are we going to do? I'm not even going to be able to bring this thing up to Jerusalem. And so he leaves it at a guy's house for 3 months, retreats back to Jerusalem. And what we learn in Chronicles is that he's having a little think about what's going on. And we realize through Chronicles that he's like, oh, we put it on a new cart. We had the wrong people carrying it. We're not supposed to look in it or touch it. We did all these things wrong. Meanwhile, for 3 months, this guy, Obed-Edom, and his whole family who are housing the ark are receiving blessing. Maybe God isn't intent on judging and destroying people. Maybe he's determined to bless. Maybe that is his heart. And maybe when we disobey and do it pretty intentionally, like the king is supposed to write out the Torah, he should know this stuff. Maybe we like forfeit some of that blessing. And so David tries for round two, and he goes up to Obed-Edom's house. He gets the ark. He gets the right people to carry it in the right way. And David dresses up in a linen ephod. And I was thinking, oh, it'd be so funny if I came up here today dressed in bright colors, maybe a Patagonia vest and some slacks with like a checked shirt and some brown loafers, golf bag slung over. I just didn't say anything, just no explanation. Because that's kind of what happens in chapter 6. There's no explanation of what's going on, but David dresses up like a high priest, does all the stuff the high priest does. He blesses the people in the name of the Lord. He offers the sacrifices that only the high priest can offer. It's so weird. It's like David thinks that he's the real high priest. And when was the last time we had a high priest of God that was hanging out in Jerusalem, acting in a way that was superior to, I don't know, Abraham? Melchizedek. We went through, oh my gosh, chapters of Melchizedek in our study of Hebrews. It's like David's calling back to this weird incident, and he's like, I know what God's heart is. He's looking for a priest king who can unite his people, who can bring his people into a relationship close to his presence. Huh, that's weird. And here's the other thing. This is how it leads to peace. See, the focus on the enthronement of Yahweh is brought out by the repetition of the word ark. It's used 15 to 16 times, depending on how you count in this chapter. But there's an equal number of sevens on either side of those disputed two. It's the ark of God and the ark of the Lord. Seven times the ark of the Lord, seven times the ark of God. And that two-time repetition of seven points to a sabbatical theme, that idea of peace, rest, what God does on the seventh day after he has brought order out of chaos and he's brought beauty into the land and he's installed his chosen representative in the Garden of Eden, where proximity to his presence can lead to worship and praise. God rests. It's a sign of his rule and his heart for humanity. And so the Lord of hosts, Yahweh Sabaoth, becomes the Lord of the Sabbath. It's God's presence that gives us the ability and the reason to praise but also that gives us peace. Now, how does peace lead to Jesus? First, there's a postscript, and I want to touch on it because it's a little troubling for some folks. While David has been kicking up his heels, worshiping God with all his might and acting like the high priest, Michael has been hanging out in her ivory tower, looking down with disapproval. She despises David in her heart. And David blesses all the people and decides, I'm going to go home and bless my own house too. And when David returned home to bless his household, we see in verse 20, Saul's daughter Michal came out to meet him. She says, oh, how the king of Israel honored himself today. He exposed himself today in the sight of the slave girls of his subjects like a vulgar person. She's accusing him of being a son of vulgarity or worthlessness, a son of Belial. And she's saying that the way that the king acts is like this. That's not very kingly. I'm Michal, the daughter of Saul. David replies to Michal, it's before the Lord who chose me over your father and his whole family to appoint me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I'll dance before Yahweh, and I will dishonor myself and humble myself even more. However, by the slave girls you spoke about, I will be honored. And Saul's daughter Michal had no children to the day of her death. Now here's the pastoral moment that we're going to touch on before we get to Jesus. In the Old Testament, blessing is almost always connected to fertility. Fertility of the land, fertility of the flocks, and fertility of households. And for people who have struggled with that, who have not been able to have children, who don't have children, it can feel confusing. Like, has God cursed me? Is there something I have done? And I know people who struggled for years to get pregnant, and they were convinced that if they could just do the right thing, if they could just obey God enough, he would give them children. That is counter to the gospel, but totally understandable as a way to think, because it's so tied in. Now, two things. One, we know that in the Old Testament, this was because the pervasive view was of a subsistence people. If the land doesn't produce, we don't eat. If the flocks don't produce, we don't have any like posterity. We don't have any way of accumulating security, wealth, the ability to like be. And if we don't produce, we don't have anybody that'll take care of us in our old age. So God sees that and he's like, I'll work with that. I can work with that. But what we know from the gospel is that while God used to populate his kingdom by proactive productivity, shall we say, by offspring, in the New Testament, we learn that God populates his kingdom through the preaching of the gospel, through regeneration, people coming into new life through relationship with God. And so the way that God used to populate his kingdom has changed. And this is why Isaiah can say, worship, be overjoyed, barren woman, because the woman with no children has seven, while the woman with seven children has none. God's flipped the script on blessing. And he said, that's not the way that I am giving you a sign of blessing anymore. But two, it's not that God has closed the womb of Michal. The text doesn't say that. It just says Saul's daughter, Michal, had no children to the day of her death. How's the relationship between David and Michal right now? Yeah. I mean, he's harsh. He's a jerk. Don't be like David. But also, she's not great and clearly not interested in an overjoyed worship of Yahweh. And so there's this thing. And what we learn in 2 Samuel 21, verses 8, is that in almost all of the Hebrew manuscripts, except for two and the Septuagint, that Michal had five kids with another guy. And so what's most likely going on is that David sent her away. He's cursed her and sent her into exile. And so what I think theologically is going on is that the text is trying to say those who recognize and honor the Lord's anointed will receive blessing. But those who refuse to recognize and dishonor God's anointed will receive cursing and exile. That's the theological message. And that ties us into the Jesus component. How can you know that God is for you, that he provides? How can you know that he will protect? How can you know that he's present? The whole structure of 1 Samuel, when David comes on the scene, to this point in 2 Samuel, is of an elected, anointed priest king who faces opposition and faces tests, but is successful in passing those tests. And through the opposition, is installed as God's chosen king, who clears the land of the snake people, because remember, the Philistines are depicted as serpents and offspring of serpents repeatedly, clears the land of the snake, defeats evil, leads the people up into worship into a new Eden space, and they experience the blessing of a new creation. That's the structure. That's the theological message of 1 Samuel from when David comes on the scene around 12 up until 2 Samuel, really 2 Samuel 8. Does this sound familiar? This is the promise in Genesis 3 of a snake-crushing seed of the woman. This is the promise throughout the Old Testament that somewhere God is going to install a righteous king who doesn't take a lot of wives, as David does in two different places, who isn't a harsh husband, who isn't like David in all of his failings, but is very much like David in all of his successes. And that this priest king, when he comes into Jerusalem, will not come as a conquering king, but he will come as a humble servant who will die in place of the people who are in very need of his blessing. And so this is how you can know that God is for you. But he doesn't stay dead. He is risen on the third day by God's Spirit. And he is reigning from God's space right now and promises to come back. And this is how you can know he's not only for you, but he's with you. And that he will protect you. Maybe not from everything, but ultimately in a very cosmic sense, in an eternal sense. And this is how you can know that he is worthy of your patience, your prayer, and your praise. So let's pray and worship now. Father, we are grateful for your Son, who reminds us of your love for us. That it's not because of anything we have done, but it's because of who you are that we have this confidence that you're with us and for us. Pray that you would make us people who are patient, but who act, confident that you're with us. We are people that seek your guidance in our lives and trust you with the outcome, and people who use all of our lives, not just singing on Sundays, but our work and our play, our gifts and our resources and all of who we are to give you praise. To ascribe value to you as a person worthy of all that we have. We turn to you with worship now. Amen.